welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Dr. John Kirkwood, director of the Melanoma Center at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Hillman Cancer Center, about using immunotherapy for treating melanoma and how to monitor responses in patients properly. So first, I just really want to start with treatment options in melanoma. What are the current approved therapies for melanoma?
So it's been a remarkable ride. Having been in melanoma therapy for the better part of 50 years, it's humbling to think that for the first 40 of those, we had no treatments that were survival improving. We had, for advanced metastatic disease, we had no effective adjuvant therapies until the late 90s. And now we have more than a dozen approved survival-improving therapies for metastatic disease, and we have another more than half dozen available for the adjuvant treatment of patients who've had resection, have a residual high risk of relapse that we want to mitigate. So it's really become a wonderful and diametrically opposite situation to what we had literally just 10 years ago, when we were still giving chemotherapy. We were still giving combinations of chemotherapy, which were toxic and had no demonstrable survival benefit in this disease, melanoma.
And so how do you select the best therapy for a given patient? And I guess really, what are the factors that you consider?
Yeah. So categorically, when we think about melanoma, we dichotomize the disease into two major categories. Those patients who have a mutation in the gene known as BRAF are candidates for inhibitors of BRAF and the downstream MEK gene that are part of the mitogen activated protein kinase pathway that are hugely effective at remitting disease and quickly remit disease, so that for patients who have BRAF, what are known as either the V600E or the V600K mutations, these are therapies of extremely rapid benefit, and they have benefits in metastatic disease that were, when we first observed them, truly miraculous. They have now, since 2017, also survival benefit durable at well over 3 years in the adjuvant setting with dabrafenib and trametinib combined. That benefit has been one of the truly remarkable stories of progress in this disease in the advanced setting as well as in the adjuvant setting over the past decade. For those patients who don't have a BRAF mutation, we consider other things that may be important for the immune response that we hope to then manipulate to therapeutically improve their situation to regress disease, or in the case of the adjuvant setting, to prevent its return. There we have an expanding array, which I think continue to expand even this year in June, with the first generation checkpoint inhibitors available and first shown to be a benefit in metastatic unresectable disease in 2011. The second generation, which became available and are known as programmed death inhibitors, where the first were known as cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4 inhibitors. And those second generation inhibitors became available only a few years after the advent of the first generation. And because their benefit was more than several times better, the response rate was 30 to 40%. Where the response rate to the first generation was 10%, the toxicities were less. They were even three or four times less. We had agents that were therefore many times more effective than the first generation single agent CTLA-4 blockade agents that really transformed the field in 2011. As of this past June, we have the first representative of the third generation of checkpoint molecules, what is known as LAG-3, has come of age in a trial called Relativity-047, presented to the ASCO meetings and showing benefits over PD-1 inhibitors alone, over nivolumab alone, which may take us a step forward because their toxicity were considerably less than the toxicities of the prior double checkpoint inhibitor therapy known as CTLA-4 PD-1 blockade or IPI-NIVO as a combination. We also saw the first evidence that the first doublet CTLA-4 PD-1 is actually significantly better, not only in terms of progression-free survival, but now at last in terms of overall survival than the PD-1 alone. But with the advent of this new LAG-3 PD-1 combination, I think we have a really brightening future for patients, even those who don't have BRAF mutated and the access to the oral BRAF MEK inhibitors. So the division of the field into BRAF mutated and BRAF wild type, the sort of the major divide that we have in patients with advanced disease. I think we also think about how symptomatic the patient is, how acute the treatment benefit needs to be, and the overall comorbidities of the patient when thinking about what therapies they are best to be advised to pursue.
And so you really touched on a lot of the treatment effectiveness for patients. And so how do you weigh those two variables, efficacy versus safety, when deciding on a treatment?
Yeah, so I think it's a shared journey with the patient that we really need to go through the description of all of the potential toxicities, all of the potential benefits in terms of progression-free survival and in terms of overall survival, and then to let the patient decide whether they want to pursue very aggressive therapy with potentially significant immune-related adverse events, or single-agent therapies, which have arguably up until this year been of similar benefit in terms of overall survival. But now I think as we have FDA action at some point later in the year for LAG-3, even better combinations that may have the benefits without all of the toxicities that we've seen from prior CTLA-4 PD-1 blockade in these patients.
What are some of the considerations for use of immunotherapy in patients with melanoma?
So I think in the metastatic disease setting, the sites of disease that the patient has are often a cardinal consideration with respect to pursuit of therapy. In patients who have, for instance, brain metastatic disease, the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab, CTLA-4 PD-1 blockade, has been shown to have similar benefits in patients with brain disease to the benefits that we've seen in peripheral non-CNS disease. That has, I think, nudged us all to consider the doublet, the original doublet, ipilimumab, nivolumab, in the treatment of any patients who have brain disease, where the presence of one site of brain disease often implies the risk for additional sites that may need to be treated. We in Pittsburgh have had the benefit of a very effective but focal therapy of disease, what is called stereotactic radiosurgery, which has the ability to obliterate brain disease in patients with solitary metastasis, often with many, many years of benefit in those patients from the SRS alone. But in patients who have more than one site of brain disease, the likelihood of additional brain disease emerging is the impetus to think about double checkpoint blockade because of the durability of the benefit and the efficacy of that doublet therapy in patients with brain disease, especially when it is asymptomatic and especially when it does not require steroid therapy in anything over minimal dosages. which may mitigate some of the benefits of those immunotherapies, the double immunotherapies that we've talked about. So patients with asymptomatic brain disease often picked up on screening tests that we do. We have really, I think, a promising future with the ipilimumab-nivolumab combination, which will also have efficacy, of course, for extracranial disease in those same patients if they have this.
And so you've touched on this combination a lot. And to kind of wrap up this idea, I wanted to ask, you know, how do you decide if or even when to use single agent immunotherapy versus a combination like nivolumab, ipilimumab?
Yeah, I think the single agent therapy is something we can, and meaning by that, anti-PD-1, either nivolumab or pembrolizumab, is highly effective and durably of benefit in a substantial fraction of patients with metastatic disease. So those who really do not want to accept the toxicity rate that was previously associated with ipilimumab, nivolumab, are really people that we often consider starting off with single agent anti-PD-1 therapy. We have many trials of PD-1 plus other agents, and those trials are our first consideration for patients with untreated disease. One of those, happily, is the PD-1 LAG-3 combination that was reported at ASCO to be of benefit, and perhaps of benefit to the same degree that we see with the first generation and second generation, now with the second generation and third generation agents, and the lesser toxicity seen in Relativity 047, and our own experience in the trial that we call here 18071, which is the lead trial of our SPOR in melanoma, basically are able to offer patients benefits that we may have previously thought only attainable from first and second generation with these second and third generation immunotherapies combined.
I wanted to transition to monitoring responses to therapy. In general, what options are there for monitoring a patient on therapy? And then how do you use each?
Yeah, of course, the first dictum that we all have is to do no harm, and to monitor for toxicity is therefore key. We discovered in a neoadjuvant trial of the first generation checkpoint inhibitor CTLA-4 that we could predict which patients who were going to start ipilimumab were at greater risk of, say, colitis by the presence of IL-17 levels at baseline before they ever received any treatment. Those kinds of markers of inflammation done before treatment may help us to mitigate the toxicity of these agents by being able to predict who is destined, who is likely to have undue toxicity with these agents. Obviously, if we're using second and third generation agents that have a much lower risk of colitis, we have other concerns like the risk for pneumonitis or dermatitis or hepatitis, which are all significant considerations with PD-1 alone, but also in combination with PD-1 and LAG-3, or PD-1 and TIGIT, or TIM-3, the other third generation agents coming down the pike. So I think monitoring for toxicity and monitoring for potential biomarkers that may predict toxicity is key. And we discovered in patients who are being treated with the old first generation agents, both tremelimumab and ipilimumab, that patients who had inflammatory conditions, for instance, in the bowel, diverticulitis, one of those that are pretty common out there, were at greater risk of colitis with the first generation checkpoint inhibitors. So those simple historic items need to be carefully checked in each of these patients. Similarly, patients who have arthritides, rheumatoid arthritis, other autoimmune pre-existing conditions may well be at increased risk of those toxicities with the checkpoint inhibitors, both first and second, and now maybe also third generation agents as we go forward. The monitoring of the tumor is something that we have considered as important to treatment. And one of the truly promising approaches to monitoring disease response in patients, both on targeted therapies, but also on immunotherapies, may be to monitor ctDNA, DNA of the tumor that is circulating in the blood, and for which there exist several options now for doing molecular testing in the blood over time that may guide us, before we ever see clinical manifestations of relapse, to determine who will relapse even months ahead of the clinical manifestation. So I think ctDNA monitoring and panels of patients' own tumor markers that can be monitored in these ways are, I think, truly promising ways for the future. Because many of these therapies are immunotherapies, we have the players of the immune system that can also be monitored in the tumor. No surprise, the presence of T cells is a predictor of susceptibility to benefit with the checkpoint inhibitors. And we've known this for many years. The presence of T cells, as Tom Gajewski showed, the presence of T cell transcripts, even at a molecular level in the tumor, augured for a better outcome in these patients if they had T cell inflamed tumors. Of course, the opposite is T cell barren or desert-like tumors, where in the absence of T cells, many of these agents may have a much more difficult job at achieving an anti-tumor response. So with this in mind, we've taken one of the biggest gaps in the field as the target of our current therapies. We have multiple trials which try to, if you will, stir up the tumor and to induce inflammation, T cell infiltration in the tumor that will then allow those patients who have failed PD-1 treatments, which are a large category, either with failure to PD-1 or failure to PD-1 plus CTLA-4, whom we must deal with. I mean, in overview, more than half of patients we treat with PD-1 will have progression. And if they have acquired resistance, and if they have initial resistance, refractoriness, there may be different significances that we attribute to the T cell inflammation. The other cells that are in the tumor that have been historically of interest to us from the first generation checkpoint inhibitors is the presence of suppressive immune elements in the tumor. What are known as myeloid-derived suppressor cells were discovered in our studies of neoadjuvant anti-CTLA-4, and the presence of MDSCs, as they are abbreviated, has a huge influence upon the susceptibility of the patient to benefit with these agents, and equally to other interventions that are immunologic, like the vaccines that are being tested and developed in melanoma, as well as many other tumors. Thirdly, a population of cells known as T regulatory cells that we have known about for quite some time are now the focus of monitoring studies that we're doing to try to determine whether our current agents may actually mitigate these populations. And we've discovered this in the context of PD-1 PI3 kinase inhibitors several years ago, presented to AACR, but in trials that are currently underway at our institution, the combination of PI3 delta gamma inhibitors with PD-1 may restore sensitivity to anti-PD-1 in those patients who have previously failed to benefit from PD-1 alone in our population. So many options, I think, to reverse resistance to PD-1, which is the single biggest gap we see in the field right now. The approach to changing the microbiome, my colleagues Divakar Devar, Hassan Zarour, and our group, have shown can reverse PD-1 resistance simply by changing the microbiome of the gut. It has yet to be done, but it's obviously an implication of those studies that monitoring the microbiome may be important to determining who is susceptible to benefit with anti-PD-1 agents in the future. And that would be a welcome option if we could simply just restore microbial contents that would then add to benefit with the anti-PD-1 agents.
Right. And so how often do you monitor your patients? And I think you touched on this briefly, but does the monitoring strategy vary according to the therapy type?
Yeah, so we monitor patients usually on protocol. So it's usually protocol specified, and the intervals, because some of these tests are fairly laborious, at monthly or 3-monthly intervals are when it is really possible to do tissue biopsy to assess tumor infiltrating lymphocyte populations, the presence of MDSCs, Tregs. Obviously, in trials that we're conducting where we do a lead-in for a month with one or another agent and then proceed with doublet therapy, we may need to do baseline 1 month and then 3 month reassessment of these populations of cells. And now with the really Star Wars approaches to monitoring the cell populations in tumors, we have what is known as single cell RNA sequencing that displays by the transcript profile what the function of each of the cells in a given tumor may be, so as to tell us whether the intervention with, say, PD-1 or, say, LAG-3 or, say, the two of them together achieve different ends, achieve different populations, activation that may then be salutary with anti-tumor benefit in those patients.
How big of a concern in your practice is pseudoprogression? And really, what do you do when you suspect progression but really aren't sure?
Yeah, so it's an interesting issue, and I think we all wanted to believe that by inducing inflammation, we might see tumor enlargement that was spurious, was really not related to the tumor cells themselves being more bulky and larger, but due to the inflammatory infiltrate, which would lead to, quote, pseudo progression. I must say that I've been a doubting Thomas on the side in regard to this phenomenon, especially with PD-1. It may have been more prevalent and more valid with CTLA-4, but remember that CTLA-4 got us benefits, you know, measurable tumor regression in a very small fraction, and 10%, you know, would have been a liberal view of that. The PD-1 response rate, 35, 40%, is, I think, infrequently accompanied by, quote, pseudoprogression. And I think the best way to interpret pseudoprogression versus real progression is how the patient feels. In a patient who feels remarkably better, is a month out on therapy, and has what seems to be palpable enlargement of, say, a lymph node, I think it's perfectly fine to continue until the usual benchmark of 2 or 3 months of therapy. But in patients who have a month or 2 months of therapy, a larger, say, palpable lymph node, and feel terrible and are feeling worse, I think it's worthy of reassessment, of imaging reassessment for a global assessment of the disease, and then for consideration of alternative therapies that may turn the ship around, because it sounds then, I think, much more like real progression than, quote, pseudoprogression.
I want to transition to ctDNA to monitor response. And you spoke a little bit about ctDNA. So to start, could you just briefly describe what it is?
So ctDNA is the molecular profile of the DNA of tumor tissue of that given patient. And there are some corporate ventures now using the DNA obtained at initiation of therapy to then create a profile for the given patient and to monitor whether this is going up or going down over treatment with an immunotherapy or a targeted therapy. Perhaps one of the simplest DNA markers of tumor progression is the DNA markers of BRAF. So we don't have BRAF in our blood. BRAF has been shown by Mark Middleton, others in his group at Oxford, to be useful in the monitoring of patients on a VEGF inhibitor that was given as an adjuvant therapy, predicting long before manifest clinical evidence of progression those patients who would have progression because BRAF elevating in the blood, the ctDNA of BRAF, were a viable, valuable, I should have said, predictor of relapse in those patients. And so I think we look forward to increasingly specific and precise ctDNA profiles for our patients being used to monitor the status of tumor. But this is still, I think, investigational, needs prospective validation, and is something that at the moment is done in clinical trials, but not in standard care.
What do clinical trials tell us about how ctDNA can help assess response to treatment?
Yeah, so I think clinical trials will tell us whether the use of ctDNA prospectively in the context of large phase three trials is going to be a useful surrogate. And ideally, the hope we would have is that we don't need to wait until tumor burden assessed by radiologic or clinical features are manifest and the freight train is right at our doorstep. If we can, by ctDNA, do molecular markers that long ahead of clinical manifestations of relapse allow us to change our approach, we may achieve ultimately greater anti-tumor benefits. Effects that are now limited with particular agents may, with succession of agents chosen on the basis of flux in ctDNA, be superior to therapy guided by clinical assessment. Manual, palpable disease is obviously the last thing we want to have to deal with. Radiologic manifestations of pulmonary, hepatic, brain, other sites of metastatic disease are also something that, if we could avoid them by having molecular markers that long ahead of that predict disease progression, this would be, I think, really a wonderful advent in our field.
And so how do ctDNA levels, or really changes in those levels, correlate with patient outcomes like overall survival or progression-free survival?
Yeah, those are currently under study. And I think that's what we really need to see in prospective trials. There are a variety of trials in the US and globally now using ctDNA markers. One of the first of these was the VEGF inhibitor trial that I mentioned. Mark Middleton, Dr. Corey Pippicori have reported from the UK, but I think many more trials need to be done like that, that will allow us to assess ctDNA flux on a monthly or three-monthly basis as the index of therapeutic strategy change, so that we're not staying with an agent that is already, by ctDNA parameters, manifestly ineffective. It may take months longer to see the gross evidence of relapse that validate this, but if we can change with the ctDNA flux, we will be way ahead of the eight ball, I think, in this.
How might ctDNA be used to monitor patients with melanoma?
So I think there are two arenas here. First, the active disease, the measurable active disease, where we can, of course, make correlations much quicker because those patients have radiologically assessable or palpable disease that, when we say it gets larger, either on the X-ray or the CT or the PET scan or by physical exam, we can measure whether ctDNA has tracked with that or not. But the area where ctDNA is, I think, of the largest potential benefit is actually the adjuvant arena, where the patient doesn't have any measurable disease. We historically give patients a whole year of treatment with, in the old days, interferon, the agent we developed in ECOG 30 years ago. But since 2017, PD-1 of two different types, dabrafenib, trametinib, MEK and BRAF inhibitor combination, which are highly effective, twice as effective as our earlier adjuvant therapies, but we're still shooting in the dark because we don't have measured disease in those patients to follow. And we give them arbitrarily a year of therapy, which may waste many, many months of those patients' time if the ctDNA evidence of disease relapse could be monitored and could be shown to indicate the need for additional alternative therapies in a subset of patients who are relapsing under our eyes, but there's nothing yet that we can see to document this and to occasion a change in the treatment that they are pursuing. Happily, with the avalanche of new therapies that we have, the alternative options for treatment are not limited at this point, but we stay with therapies for an arbitrary year because that's what we did 35 years ago in the original adjuvant trial. And there is no solid reason to stay on that therapy for a whole year if there is molecular evidence of progression, of failure, of disease resurgence that should dictate alternative therapies. The flip side of this is the option for actually terminating therapy, of declaring victory, may exist in patients who have no evidence of disease clinically, as all of these patients have been resected free of disease, but also have no molecular evidence of disease on treatment at some point in time. Is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? Is it 9 months? I am sure when we know these data, it will not be 12 months, that we can stop earlier and spare these patients the cost, the morbidity, the time that is required for the arbitrary adjuvant 1 year of treatment that we have been given to these patients with all of our agents, and some of them for even more than that. The ipilimumab adjuvant regimen approved in 2015 was a 3 year regimen. The PEG-INTRON regimen approved in 2011 was a 5 year treatment. Were these necessary? I think not. But even the 1 year, which has been our standard since 1684, the original interferon trial, has no real solid justification. And with molecular markers, sensitive molecular markers that are precise, I think it would be possible to intelligently, rationally approach this and limit the therapy that we're giving to our patients.
Right. And so, as you know, ctDNA testing is relatively new. So what evidence would you want to see in order to incorporate a new test into routine clinical practice?
I think rigorous phase three correlatives are needed. And I think we need to have evidence that both relapse-free survival in the adjuvant setting and overall survival correlate to the molecular parameters that we're following here. The FDA and some of our NCI CTEP statisticians have for many, many years said only survival makes a difference and an impact that shows survival impact of this marker-guided therapy would be the absolute gold standard. In these days when almost none of our trials have a primary endpoint of survival anymore, because it takes a decade to get to, or at least many years, we have increasingly thought about alternatives. And one of them, for instance, is the neoadjuvant trial, where you give prior to surgery a month, 2 months, at the outside, 3 months of therapy, and then use the pathological evidence at resection to give a pathological index of pathologic complete response, pathologic major response, or non-response. And I think the proponents of neoadjuvant trials, which we have done more of in Pittsburgh than any other place in the world, have some of them said this should be already accepted by the FDA. FDA have, I think, stood their ground and rigorously insisted that we have more trials and more statistically solid data to argue that the neoadjuvant treatment is effective and that that pathologic readout is as valuable as all of us think it is. But that data will come with larger numbers, multiple site studies, And in our cooperative groups in the US, we are doing the first multi-center neoadjuvant trials in the National Clinical Trials Network. Those, I think, will provide the kind of rigor and multi-institutional prospective validation that the FDA is properly asking for here.
Lastly, I want to transition to other clinical decision points. How do you handle when your patients request a drug holiday?
So drug holiday is an interesting thing. Interruptions in therapy, we are all familiar with. And remarkably, whether it's dabrafenib, trametinib, or interferon alpha, our old immunotherapy, or PD-1, fatigue and toxicity manifest in fatigue are the single biggest complaint that many patients have. And they're there with targeted therapies, they're there with our old immunotherapy with interferon alpha, and they are there certainly with PD-1, where that fatigue, I think, often leads a patient to ask, can they take a break? The problem is, whereas the kinetics of BRAF and MEK therapy tell us that if we stop, we can expect the patient will begin to recover in days or a week. With PD-1, the impact may be weeks and weeks, and the acuity of the fatigue, if that is the motivation to have a drug holiday, is a little bit more difficult to rationalize. I think the drug holiday notion was, for BRAF MEK inhibitor therapy at least, a major concern with the interesting data that emerged more than 8 years ago in mouse models, where intermittent therapy, treatment for 3 weeks and then a week off, actually achieved superior outcomes in melanoma therapy in the mouse by comparison with continuous uninterrupted therapy. And so for a while, we actually thought that interrupted therapies might actually be, at least with BRAF and MEK inhibitors, superior. SWOG did a trial that's known as S1320, which sadly did not show that interrupted therapy with BRAF MEK inhibitors did achieve significantly better outcomes. And so I think for the moment, we try to limit the period of time off treatment to ameliorate the symptoms of fatigue or the symptoms of fever that we see with dabrafenib, trametinib as a concern. And then we can often resume therapy without dose attenuation and carry the patient on through the period of treatment, especially in the adjuvant setting where we think perhaps doing this has curative potentials for patients that we would not want to forsake by dropping the dose or by interrupting it for too long.
Right, and you've touched on a little bit of the clinical investigations going on around this, but from what you've seen, what can a drug holiday do to the efficacy of a treatment?
Well, clearly, if drug holiday winds up being repeated and associated with dose attenuation, it can actually lose us the benefit that we have hoped to gain from the BRAF MEK inhibitor pair that a patient is being treated with. But on the other side, when it's done judiciously and allows the patient to stay with therapy through the entire prescribed period of treatment, say the year of adjuvant therapy, the hope is that interruptions, not wholesale and not for long periods of time, may allow the patient to complete therapy, which they otherwise would not be able to complete.
Similar to this, duration of treatment can also be challenging to determine. So do you treat indefinitely? And really, when do you consider stopping therapy for a patient?
Yeah, this is a key question for the field now. And I think the question of how long is enough is a question that all of our patients ask us and that we have to admit we don't really have rigorous evidence to support the indefinite treatment recommendation that some pharma have advised. Speaking now of checkpoint blockade immunotherapies not of BRAF MEK targeted therapies. But I think for the checkpoint blockade immunotherapies, either single agent anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-1 with anti-CTLA-4, in the National Clinical Trials Network, we're actually now taking the opportunity to assess patients at 1 year of therapy for their degree of response, to assess radiographically by CT whether tumor has regressed and stayed down, by PET whether metabolic activity is absent, say at a year, and if the patient has response and absent PET activity, to say enough may be the 1 year of treatment. That trial is now ongoing in ECOG Akron. Physicians who are able should consider patients for that trial. And I think the opportunity to mitigate the duration of therapy without losing the benefit of the checkpoint blockade is there and needs to be proven. Obviously, this needs to be done on a trial. It needs to be done with either PET cold disease, CT response in disease, or biopsy of a mass that may be residual fibrosis without any viable tumor before a patient is removed from therapy, ideally, as I said, on protocol. But I think this is an issue for the future. It needs prospective trials of discontinuation with those kinds of measures that I've mentioned. And with that, we hope that we may actually be able to come to a rational set of guidelines for stopping therapy at response at a year in patients who are asymptomatic, and may be able to then enjoy protracted periods of time in continued response without the need of further therapy.
And do you think ctDNA could potentially help with informing this decision?
Absolutely. There is no question of that whatsoever. And in the National Clinical Trials Network and in institutional trials with a variety of collaborators, this is something that is now being addressed. But that needs to be data-driven, evidence-based going forward.
And do you have any information on how that might happen, or do you think it's too early to tell?
I think it's still too early to tell, but I think that is something that we can look forward to in the not too distant future.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.